Thank you. It's Cliff Ransom. I guess this question is for Nick, but if any of the operating heads want to speak to it. You seem to talk about Lean Six Sigma as a short-term cost. My experience is that's pretty much of a pay-as-you-go metric, pay-as-you-go process. And then number two, I'm struck that when you talk about investing in Lean Six Sigma, you talked about the number of black belts. How would you respond to the thought that that's the wrong metric? The metric is the one that your customers see, which is quality, delivery, cost, innovation, safety.
Am I Mike? Right. Yeah. A few things, and then others can chime in after me. We see our investment in Lean Six Sigma as just that, an investment. It happens to be one that gets very fast payback, as you can see by the graph that I was showing of the financial returns that we were generating, that most of our black belts that we put into Lean Six Sigma are generating returns that more than pay their salary the very first year they're in place. In terms of the part of the question on short-term versus long-term, part of what where we're going with Lean in 3M is how do we use Lean to redesign our supply chains in order to make our efficiency and effectiveness with our customers even better. And that's where we design processes that are focused on what's the most value-adding to our customers and taking out parts of the process that are not adding value to our customers. So especially in the Lean portion of Lean Six Sigma, we see relevance for that. The Six Sigma portion is largely directed at how do you take defects out of the process? Mm-hmm. Defects that add cost or defects that can take away from the customer experience. Mm-hmm.
There is a direct correlation, of course, in between the belt and the output, right? And I wouldn't like you to come across with a message that we are a company that are insular relative to look upon things we do internally only for the internal thing. Of course, everything we do has and should have a benefit for the customers. But in terms of Six Sigma, you know, Mike Roman, as he's leading our biggest business, maybe you, Mike, can make some comments relative to number of belts and the value for each, et cetera, how you do that in one third of the company. Yes, so you get the feeling for. So it's a good question, actually, around Lean Six Sigma.
I think the way Inga said it is right. It's correlated with the number of black belts, but it goes well beyond black belts. We have a green belt army that helps to deploy Lean Six Sigma projects, and we have lean managers that are part of that deployment. But the black belts are an important leadership component of our Lean Six Sigma model. They're the ones out there at a plant level, at an operational level, really marshaling the forces and really driving a Lean Six Sigma focus. We call it a wave one intensity kind of focus for us in our industrial business. So it is much more than the black belts, but that's an important element of it that we really want to focus on, making sure we have that leadership around the world, really. Mm-hmm. And I would say, as Nick said, we get a very short-term return on that, but it has a long-term impact on our enterprise. And we're seeing 20% plus of our savings now coming from lean implementation. And that's a long-term payback. I mean, that continues to pay dividends for years to come. Mm-hmm.
I think also, yes, I just would like to talk about it for a second because it's an important element of efficiency. So as you recall, there was a time in 3M where Six Sigma was embedded in many, many things, starting back maybe in 2002 or something, went for 5-6 years. Then came a period where maybe, you know, if you like to use it, please go ahead and use it as a tool. You also see on the ramp up, you know, we are revitalizing Lean Six Sigma into the company, and it will stay there as we move forward, and specifically in manufacturing and supply chain. And that's why I feel very encouraged relative to the momentum that is there now. I think everyone in 3M understand the benefit from it and all the focus we're putting on it. And we are a company, as you know, when we put emphasis from the center of the company in terms of initiative, we get it done, right? So I'm very encouraged in terms of what will happen in the next many years to come, right? So.
Next question, Ajay.
Thank you, good morning.
Morning.
So, Inga, on one of your charts, you had the various divisions, and you had three circles around the Heartland push forward and the one strategic review.
Yeah.
But there were some businesses that were outside those circles. So maybe mm-hmm. just talk about how we should think about those businesses. Are those like cash cows, or
yeah.
could they move to one of those circles over time?
Yeah. So think about in this way, you know, when we started the journey, the first evaluation we did was to understand the value strategically and financially for the company, and which business have more opportunity, and also specifically, which businesses have lagged the company for the last 5 years. We identify them under strategic review. The ones that we call at the time in transition was businesses that I would say still had opportunity, but at least in my mind, was our plan was not really clear. Now, if you think about that in terms of how we have addressed businesses under strategic review, which went at from 2.5 billion to is less than 500 million as we speak. And by the way, that bubble is a collection of smaller businesses, right? So it's not one big business. It's small things that all the business groups now are addressing. Almost 3 years into the plan, you are not any longer in transition. You will have, by the end of this year, moving into next year, a plan of where you are going. So I would say you're not allowed in 3M to be a business under transition for that long time. The question at that point for me was, so what is the plan? We need to develop the plan together and make sure you get the resources you need, or we have to do something else. So I think that was, I would say, was not a burning platform at all if you were in transition. Was just like, we need collectively to develop a plan. So you should not be in transition as you move ahead, right? You are, and as I said, portfolio management is not a project, that's a process. So people will go in and out relative to what you need to have help with. And my view of 3M as we move ahead, when we started, if you got the information, you're under strategic review, that sounds bad. And it was maybe not the best place to be. When we move forward, if we under strategic review, that's for an opportunity. That's a strategic review based on an offensive mode. What can we do better in order to move forward? So that's my view on it.
Just one more, if I can sneak in on pricing, Dave. In your model, you had pricing up next year. So maybe just big picture with the raw material environment kind of being benign, does that kind of limit your pricing opportunity next year? Or given that a lot of your products are consumable type and a lot of what you do is brand driven, could you continue to get good pricing despite the weak raw material environment?
Yeah, there's multiple factors impacting pricing. Exactly what you were talking about, commodity prices having an impact on our ability to raise prices. Offsetting that is what's happening in the foreign exchange market. As many of you have probably heard me talk about before, especially in developing parts of the world, we often have the ability to adjust pricing to offset what's happening with FX, and that'll be a positive impact on pricing in 2015.
Okay. Joel, and could you just state your name and firm for the webcast, please?
Sure, Joe Ritchie, Goldman Sachs. Thanks, Matt. Inga, your team had a great year this year. And I guess, as I think about 2015, my biggest question, just broadly speaking, what are your biggest concerns, either from a portfolio standpoint, your investments, your end markets? What are you concerned about at all as you head into 15?
Yeah, I think my concern is not so much the 3M operation as such, right? I think it's more a concern that will impact all of us, but maybe geopolitically relative to the evolution of economies, right? So I think that's the biggest thing that I'm thinking of and make sure that we are very careful and type of step-by-step execute our plan. And as I said to the team is, if things are changing, we need to be able to change very fast, right? As I said to the team, if you go to the forest with your map, and at the time you see that the forest and the map does not connect. Forest is correct. Throw away the map. Mm-hmm. And you need to be able to do that. Right? I think that many companies go wrong because they still believe the map is correct, right? But it's not. So I think you have to just be careful as you move and make sure that you adapt or throw away your map if the landscape is changing and the forest is changing too much. Now, I rather think about not only 15, but beyond 15 in terms of more opportunities for us, right? And I think that all the initiatives we are taking now around our supply chain is a opportunity for us as we move ahead. And I think when I think about levers, mid to long term and also short term, what we're doing in Switzerland and Singapore and Panama, that's a big opportunity for us. And I'm very excited about that opportunity, actually, because I think we should be able to be even more efficient on our inventory terms and the value of inventory and service level and so forth. So I think that's it's an opportunity for us. But the type of concern about the operation, we have done a lot the last almost 3 years now in order to put the processes and the house in order for the future. So it's more type of what will happen around the world, and we need to adjust to it, right? It's as simple as that.
Andrew?
Just to expand, Andrew Obin, Bank of America Merrill Lynch, just to expand on your commentary, you know, as I look at your efforts on portfolio management and prioritization, you know, how far are you into these processes and how much is left? And it also seems, if I look at your reduction in business units, it seems you've sort of done a lot of heavy lifting. So what's next in terms of evolution of the process at 3M?
Yeah. I think, first of all, when you think about it, and I think it's important to think about why did you end up in the situation at that time with 40 businesses. 3M is built on and successfully built on entrepreneurship and empowerment. That also meant that the model on the many, many years evolved versus you type of separate out business in order to grow them faster. In many markets, they are consolidating, and you need today to be more relevant. That was why we start to move those businesses together. So it was relevance for customer, efficiency in the processes. Every business today, the 27 businesses, if you like, are now into the next step of challenging the portfolio of products that they are using. So I don't see there is major thing or more consolidation in between businesses, right? But we will address the last 450 to 500 million that is symbolized by one bubble. And that will happen in each business as we move ahead. I think now is more, what I feel good about is based on that work and the four fundamentals, we have a better picture, and I would say relatively good picture relative to the opportunities as we move ahead for expansion. But the expansion should be done both organically and maybe some acquisition that is close to our core, right? We know how to do it. We should take those fundamentals and build on it to drive value. That's what it is. If we not can drive value from 2.5+ of those, we have to ask our question, why will we do it? So I think it's more around that. But I think we have done a lot of work, and we see the benefit coming seriously in terms of both productivity, as you've seen lately, that is productivity in terms of less meetings, better processes, more efficiency, and then customers see it easier for to interact with us, right?
Steve?
Thanks. Steve Winoker, Bernstein. Just a question, Nick, maybe for you. Tremendous amount of detail in the presentation. Still don't know what your margin target is necessarily for next year, but on my math, putting all that together, it looks to me like 60 to 100 basis points of margin expansion pre-FX and pension, and post-FX and pension more like flat to slightly down. Am I in the ballpark?
Not quite, Steve. We. you're close to the ballpark, but I'll bring you into the ballpark.
Excellent.
We expect margin expansion of approximately 50 basis points in 2015.
And that's
all in.
All in.
All in.
Okay, great. And then the other element to that is you often in the past have shown relative international penetration. So for every 3M product that's sold in the U.S., you know, where are you in the rest of the world? And maybe this is for HC, I'm not sure, but it used to be 60% roughly, and then over time, I think it was a little bit lower, and it was calculated relative to GDP here versus rest of world. Can you maybe comment on where are you there? I won't hazard a guess in the number here because I don't need you to. I'll rather just have you go for the clarification.
HC?
Yeah, so in most countries that we operate, like in China, big countries, West Europe, our so-called self-efficiency, which means what percent of the revenue is represented by the product converted or manufactured locally, is well over 65%. So the era that a lot of products were coming from U.S. to ship it out to local countries is pretty much gone. We develop more and more locally produced and converted products. So I don't have the exact figure for the question that you asked, but we do increase the number of products and portions of locally manufactured products on a continuing basis.
HC and Steve, help me out. I think you were talking about relative penetration of sales, though, right?
Not sales. Local content.
Yeah. No. So sales.
So if you look at the U.S., take U.S. as 100, we generally have about 45 on a global basis. It's a little high in countries like West Europe, in the range of 20-25 in developing markets. So if you aggregate the whole thing, the number will be somewhere around in that range.
Scott?
Thanks, and good morning, it's Davis. You addressed this a little bit, Inga, but we have kind of a tale of two different worlds right now. You've got the oil sellers and the oil buyers, and you do sell a fair amount into countries that are, could be if nothing else, literally civil war in the next 6 months if we have $50 oil. I mean, do you have a plan B around costs? And when you think about places that, you know, whether it be Russia or Venezuela, Brazil, Mexico, places that you do have fairly substantial revenues in, that do you have a cost plan of some semblance if we run into some problems?
Yeah, you know, first of all, we are always working under a contingency plan, if you like, and specifically as you move into a new year, it's almost like that is in place immediately. So yeah, the answer is yes. I will say that coming back to the comments that HC did earlier in his presentation relative to action we are taking with prices, etc., in order to manage what is going on locally, I think that's a strength for us in terms of being able to react immediately in countries if something is happening. And reality is, it is happening, right? So we've done business for so many years outside of the United States in many places in Central East Europe and Middle East Africa and Latin America and Asia that we know that always something will happen in one way or the other. In terms of Russia, our exposure in Russia is very small. And we made that calculation accordingly when things start to be a little bit more heated relative to Ukraine and Russia. And it's less than 1% of our sales revenue is there. We have very few assets in Russia specifically. We have some manufacturing around respirators. We have some converting around Scotch-Brite product, and we have a pipeline coating facility. And the plan is not to expand, right? So I think, as I said earlier, in terms of concern, I think concern, generally speaking, if it, some geopolitical thing would start to move for us. If you take Brazil, as you talked about Venezuela, we've gone through this year. Take Brazil. Brazil is a very domestic-driven market by definition, right? So I think that's, and we have a full operation in Brazil, and what I mean full operation, we have everything there from research and development to converting manufacturing and commercialization So they are very much self-sufficient in Brazil by definition. But as I said earlier, you know, I think you, based on what is happening around the world, we are just moving piece by piece as we move forward. The important thing, though, in 3M's model is we adjust as things are happening, right? We never leave. It's very seldom we are leaving a country because things are going crazy temporarily, right? So we have always adjust and right-sized at the time, and in order to keep connection with customers and officials, et cetera, so you can, because that's coming a time when it will bounce back, so you'll be ready to go then. I think that's an important element. I think the other thing that as we, that has, of course, as we all know, been a slight adjustment in between growth in developed and developing world lately. When we sit here, you know, our expansion in international over the last many years is important to know around that expansion. We didn't leave our core. Our core is United States, if you like. We didn't leave United States and move somewhere. We moved in order to expand. And as we speak today with US, a very attractive place to be. We feel very good because we have all the capabilities here in United States, which is our home arena in a way, right? So I think it's a very good question there, but it's just to make sure that we are very careful as we roll out the plan, and we have a history of being able to do that, right? So,
okay,
excuse me, Scott, I'll add one thing. In the case of Venezuela, over the last 2 years, we've been using our ability to take cash out of that country as the governor on the amount of business that we conduct there. That has resulted in a 3M exposure in Venezuela that is very small right now. So we're looking in a good position right now for Venezuela in light of where oil prices are.
Understood, Nick. As a follow-up on just to move to M&A, you did two completely different acquisitions the last couple of years, Ceradyne, which we were essentially buying technology, and Ace, where you were buying a brand. Mm-hmm. What did you learn from the process there? Is it easier to buy a brand and like an Ace and bring it into your distribution and such, or is it better to buy the technology, or is the answer both?
I don't know if one is easier than the other. I mean, you have always, there's different elements for you to implement it. The easiest one is actually Sumitomo 3M, right? Because we're running that, and you saw relative to the multiple, very attractive. So that's what you really would like to do. Now reality is you cannot find them in that way. I think that if you buy something that is based on brand equity and with our capability to expand around the world, I think that's a model that will fit us very well. Now, we have to understand that if that brand equity is strong only one or two places geographically around the world, it takes a lot to expand it. Take it, because the brand is in our minds, right? And often that's locally driven. So it's not so easy to take a brand that is very strong in West Europe and just think that you can accelerate that in Latin America or in Asia or from US to move somewhere else. Technologies for us is very interesting and important because we can leverage that many, many places. So I will say that there's not one that is easier than the other, but I think a technology play for us done right, as you see now with Ceradyne, is moving out to multiple divisions. And as it go out to multiple division in solutions, it will also go out multiple geographical areas.
Nigel?
Matt, Nigel Coe from Morgan Stanley. Question for Nick. I want to go back to the margin ballpark, 50 bips. Does that include any benefit from the hedge, the currency hedge you got in place? And then secondly, you know, to what extent have you, you know, how have you layered in the low oil price into your 15, 25 cents benefit from materials? I mean, have you just taken, you know, current spot prices and rolled that forward, or have you made some assumption on oil prices?
In the case of the margin impact, that does include the hedge benefit that we're expecting in 2015 with the strong U.S. dollar. And how we factor in the 15 to 25 cents, which one are you referring to, Nigel?
Yeah, so, you know, the raw material tailwinds to margins. You know, how have you, factored in the lower price? Have you made an assumption on oil prices and how that impacts your input costs, or have you just taken current input costs and rolled that forward? I mean, how have you laid that?
Yeah, we look at several things. We look at what's happened in the market and looking at current market prices and what the forward market is projecting for that. We look at what we see as 3M's capability to negotiate even better opportunities. And then the third component is, where do we have the ability to swap in and out different raw materials to take advantage of arbitrage opportunities there? So it's not just a static, where's the spot market today and it means this. It's a forward-looking view for us as we project that 15 to 25 cents.
And then Inga, just a second question on the, you gave us good color on the disruptive technologies. You said 30 projects underway, 15 moved into commercialization. How does that look in 2017? You know, if R&D is 6% of sales, how many projects would you expect to have underway? And what kind of sales contribution would you expect by 2017?
Yeah, so first of all, that investment that we are doing from historical 5.5 to 6, they are in disruptive technologies and markets, meaning it will take longer time in order for us to commercialize them. And as I said earlier, there is like 7 smaller programs that are early stage commercialization, and the sales probably this year is around 100 to 125 million. That will step up slightly as we move into next year, but I think we have to wait longer term before we see the real, real benefit from it. And the reason why we changed it was that it became clear to us a couple of years ago that more risky programs around disruptive technologies was not really funded in the businesses as such, right? Because we are driving them for a result quarter by quarter. So if it's higher risk, bigger investment, we maybe hold it back. So that's why we formed this innovation board internally in order to then allocate money that we can give back. But I would say I'm very encouraged by the program we see moving forward. And as I said, there's around 30 programs in the pipeline. Now, as is always in the past for the future, is if you don't see the opportunity, you have to kill them fast and go on something else, right? But it looks good, and I see you will see, I think you will see a small step up in research and development as we go. Now, as I put on that chart, research and development is important, but we also need productivity in the outcome. So it's even if we have a statement around invest in innovation, it's the heartbeat of the company, we expect really good outcome and productivity. So they are not excluded from anything else as we are driving in the company in terms of productivity and so forth in the laboratory. But I would say that I am very pleased with initiatives in the laboratory, generally speaking. And the other thing that is really strengths for 3M is our manufacturing and our engineering capabilities. And that's part of the business model, if you like, right? And we don't talk so much about it, generally speaking, right? We talk maybe more about research and development of 5.5% or so, but also in our investment in manufacturing capability and advanced engineering is very important for our business model. So very little outsourcing, right? That's not our model, because it's quite advanced product that we are producing, generally speaking.
Martin?
Martin Sankey, Neuberger Berman. Nick, during your presentation, you mentioned the company's new product vitality index and that it is a important metric that is closely monitored. That number, I believe, has stayed about 32-33% in recent years versus a couple years ago, the company wanted to be on a path to be at 40% by the 2016-2017 time frame. Could you provide us some perspectives as to why that has happened, or is that something that the company is satisfied with, or has there been some changes in the dynamics of how you're approaching new products such that the number might be a little bit harder to obtain growth because you're focused more on breakthrough products as opposed to product line extensions.
Maybe I can address that. So NPVI, New Product Vitality Index, was introduced many years ago, and yeah, so we're all on the same page. It's a measurement of products sold today that was not introduced 5 years ago. So it's an important metric. We found out when it was introduced that our pipeline of new product was maybe not as robust as we would like. So we did two things back then. One, we put out a target of 40% NPVI, and we started, if you recall, to make many small acquisitions in order to complement the product portfolio. That second piece was a result of that we didn't see a lot of new product coming through. So when we shoot down 40%, it was like to get attention and start to move it. And we moved it probably from 18-19% up above 30, 33, 34%. I think it's 33% yes. This year. Now, important to know with NPVI, that's a secondary metric. It's a secondary metric. It's not the primary metric. The primary metric is organic local currency growth. So NPVI is supporting organic local currency growth. And as you talk about 4 to 6% organic local currency growth, NPVI will help you to drive that. Now, the other thing that is happening, if you not are successful of commercializing those products in NPVI, and you're coming closer to 40 or more, those products will end up in your inventory. So you have then to say, okay, what is the optimal position for NPVI? We moved that down from 40 to 37 or something last year or the year before. So we talk about 37%. There's no science to 37. There's no science. You will not live or die by 37. You will live and die with organic local currency growth. That is 4 to 6. So I think that's an important element. So why is NPVI important? Well, it's not important to compensate people or drive them after only that metric. But it's important because if you have an erosion in your business of 5%, 5 by 5 is 25. If you don't have an NPVI of at least 25%, you're standing still and eventually losing. So that's one important element. The other thing is, with a robust NPVI pipeline, you get more time with customers. And it's an important element in terms of you be relevant in front of your customers. So we are talking about 35, 37% or something like that. But think about it as a secondary metric for the company. Right? You should think about 4 to 6% organic local currency growth. Because I wouldn't like to have a business that have 52% NPVI but are declining. That's an issue. So it's important to understand the metric as such.
In the front row.
It's Rajiv Bauman from Oppenheimer Funds. I want to come back to the NPVI and the economic implications of it, because it is a function of the successful commercialization of R&D spend. And so the effectiveness of R&D and the productivity of R&D is demonstrated to some extent by NPVI. Could you describe a little bit about the economic characteristics of NPVI index, you know, components, and the implications for margin, as well as return on capital employed of that dynamic?
Thanks. Yeah, I'll take that. You heard every one of us today talk about the four fundamental strengths and how our analysis has shown those four fundamental strengths are enhancing our operating margins and our return on invested capital. Innovation being the first one listed there. Our ability to innovate, to create customer relevance with our customers, to be able to price products for the value that it's creating for those customers, that's part of the operating margin, but it's also a big contributor to our ability to grow organically. Sometimes during that 5-year time horizon, but as Mike talked about in his presentation, part of that growth is also coming after that 5-year time horizon as we continue to commercialize what we've already introduced. So we see our investment and the success of our innovation, investment in innovation, as enhancing both our margin and our ability to grow organically. For us, it's not one or the other.
Does that mean the components of the NPVI have higher margin than the rest of the portfolio, or is there no connection?
I would be making too much of a sweeping generalization to say that one that component has a higher or lower operating margin than others. The fact that it's there and continually in refreshing our portfolio allows us, we believe, to have an overall portfolio that has that enhanced operating income margin. Often in the first 1 or 2 years of a product introduction launch, we face higher upfront costs in getting it launched. So in that first 1 or 2 years, likely no, but over the life cycle of that product, it definitely is enhancing our operating income margin.
Steve.
Steve Tusa from JP Morgan.
Hi, Steve.
Can you maybe just talk about the fourth quarter a bit? Are there any puts and takes within the segments? And I assume you're just eating this restructuring, and is that part of the range, or is there something that's, you know, that's offsetting that?
The things that I described when I'm saying what we're seeing as we come to the end of this year are encompassed in the range that we have put out for the total year expectation.
Okay. And then just on the longer term target of 4 to 6, so you did, I think, about 3.5 and 13, you're gonna do somewhere in the range of, you know, low fours or maybe mid fours, 4.5 this year. Next year you're at kind of 3 to 6. So, you know, what gets better to get you to the high end of that range on the 4 to 6 organic? You know, I think the EPS target has been, you know, very well delivered upon with some balance sheet, extra balance sheet utilization, but I guess the core growth, what gets better? Is that something you guys control, or is that more of a macro call?
I think it's there's two elements to it, you know. So when we talk about, so 4 and 6 for the plan, and then 3, 6 going into next year. The 3 there is a type of, little bit of uncertainty as we talk about in the economy. But what will it take for us in order to move up versus the top of that range? First of all, what we feel good about, and we hope that it could be sustainable, is what we have done in the United States relative to our execution model on commercialization. As you recall, we took a hard look at that starting 2011 by focusing the U.S. businesses to focus only execution on United States. That started to pay off for us, and the economy is improving. So when you have seen the last couple of quarters, an improved growth rate in the United States, that need to continue. We also need to see that we can capitalize on the evolution of the economy in China, that is not going from export to domestic, it's type of addition to domestic. So we need to be able to commercialize on that and capitalize it, and China need to do slightly better than we see at this point in time. And then West Europe, I think, as HC rightly described it, is a slow-growing environment, but there are opportunities there. So I would say, to go on the higher end of it, you know, our plan, we are confident that we can execute on that in U.S. now as it stands. So we hope the economy stands up. And then with China and West Europe, the type of ticking up a little bit, I think we are coming closer over time. You know, it's not only gut feeling. I think that Nick showed the 1.7x IPI. It is clear that as we laid out the plan, that we see better momentum in our ability to execute from a commercialization perspective. So I feel encouraged, I would say, with the ability. So I think we are well set. And I hope that the economy is becoming slightly better in West Europe and China. And I think we need that all in order to move it closer up on the high end of the range.
And then just one last question just on the margin, I guess. You know, price raws for you guys, you know, you've done a great job of managing that. Obviously, you're going to have a big benefit in 2015. I'm a little bit surprised that price, you said slightly positive price. I mean, you guys have been getting a decent amount of price, whether it's driven by foreign exchange or just blocking and tackling. Is that kind of the run rate we should consider now on year-over-year price with your commodities down, that you're maybe giving a little bit of that back to go for volume? And then the second question is, obviously impressive, you guys are now expanding margins. Why not give a longer-term margin target? Is that something that you could add to that 2017 chart at some stage of the game, now that you're kind of on the horse there?
A couple things. On the margin expansion and the price raw materials, and why not even more price in 2015, one thing I did omit earlier, part of our ability to drive price is part of the very innovation that we've been talking about in several of the Q&A. That has been and continues to be a driver of our price growth. One reason we're not going even further with our price growth into 2015 is the commodity price issues that I've been talking about. That will be a headwind for us on our ability on price. Once I go out beyond 2015, I do not expect, I don't think we have enough visibility of what's happening with FX and what's happening with commodities to be making a statement about price growth going further than that. Other than that, what I started with, our ability to innovate and what that does for our ability to drive price in the market. As far as a longer term view, as part of our plan, when we introduced our plan for earnings per share growth, part of our plan was there were many drivers that can help us get to that 9 to 11%. To the extent that we see some things not contributing to what we expected, we may have margin as an opportunity in there for ways we can deliver that 9 to 11. But right now we're not seeing the need to, we continue to see the need to keep reinvesting in our business. And for that reason, I don't think it would be wise for us to be putting a even further out margin target. If Inga and I, or all of us up here, really needed and wanted to drive up the margin in the short term, that's always a possibility by cutting costs and doing other things. But I don't think in the long term it would be something you, the investors, would be happy with, because we'd be sacrificing many of the things that are driving our ability to grow organically over time.
Mm-hmm. I think also, yes, one thing that would be important for us is also to build a credible plan that you can follow and believe we can deliver on. And I think as we laid that out early on, there's certain thing that we would like to do, which was a reinvestment, et cetera. And we wouldn't like at this point in time, at least, to overpromise anything on the margin side. I will say that I'm encouraged with the productivity we start to see in the plan as we speak. But we have still some work to do on the strategic investment, and some are very offensive. Business transformation, we will do it. That will have incredible benefit for all of us as we go ahead. And then we have some small cleanups here and there that we try to do as well, right? So we just try to stay on the safe side, not overpromise and underdeliver. I think that's the motto here.
Jeff, right here.
Thank you. Jeff Sprague from Vertical Research. One for Inga and then just one for Nick. Inga, just back on the portfolio, to some of the earlier questions, if we think about those businesses that were not in strategic or not in strategic review, not in Heartland, and not in Push Forward, and therefore kind of in transition, so to speak, that's about $8 billion of revenue, it looks like. So I guess it's a little unclear to me how they move out of transition, what actually changes significantly enough to alter where they sit on that map is really kind of the question. And do we think about it's a margin improvement story, or it's cash, or some other kind of outcome for those businesses?
Yeah. You know, think about it, like many of those businesses that was categorized like in transition, some of them have been combined in one way or the other in order to drive efficiency and relevance to customers. So it was many of them that suddenly yes, was in transition because we had not, I would say, we had not been smart enough to really consolidate the benefit that they could do together. And in fact, I think there was even one business that was in strategic review that actually came out of that and moved forward relative to benefit by combining with a business, two businesses in transition. So I think we have done a lot of things of the, for them, and I would say they will not move into heartland as I see it. They're coming closer to push forward as we move, go ahead. When you run an enterprise like this with 90,000 people and many, many businesses, I think the important thing is that there is a process in order really to help with their business plan in terms of direction going forward. That is what we try to do. So that's what I would say, that in the end of 2015, there will not be a category called in transition, right? Then it's now your responsibility leading a business and ours to develop the plan of what this is all about as we move ahead. You know, you need to do at the first step, as I've done this on a couple of places before, inside in different geographical areas of 3M, the first is almost a shock for the organization when you start to categorize them, right? You get a lot of attention, I can tell you that. And progress start to happen, right? So it's a lot of them have been addressed. But I don't see at this point in time that that some of them will move into heartline by definition. I think they're more up to more growth and push forward.
I was wondering, as just a follow-up, for Nick on kind of the capital deployment strategy and plan, could you just kind of, maybe back to kind of the ballpark analogy, kind of bring us up to date on where you sit relative to the rating agencies, relative to how perhaps you're trying to manage the rating, your ability to flex, and I kind of asked that question maybe more in the context if your entire five-year M&A ambition happened to materialize in 2015 because these things are just episodic. You know, could you in fact do that? How would you toggle back and forth? Just frame that for us.
If you think about our total five-year capital allocation strategy, right now we're at a low AA rate debt rating. And our five-year strategy with the share buybacks, with the M&A, with the other investments that we've talked about there, with the added leverage, we have the capability to stay at a low AA and accomplish all of those things, and still with some degrees of freedom within that. It's not pushing it to the very edge. So, Jeff, I hope that's answering your question there.
Got time for two more. So, Dean?
Thank you. It's Deane Dray with RBC Capital Markets. And just to go back to the questions regarding the implications of all the investment in new products and disruptive technologies, I'd be interested in hearing either philosophically or to the P&L how you address product cannibalization. You know, I think at the end it all gets netted in your organic local currency growth, but yeah. Just what's your tolerance and how do you manage product cannibalization?
Yeah, you know, we categorize new products in three different categories. So for simplification, let's call them A, B, and C. A is where we basically introduce where we cannibalize ourselves. That's what we do in A. In B is where we develop new products into current channels and current customers. And then C is the disruptive technology. So when you look upon the facts and data, we are very good in category A. We know how to do that constantly. That's a fantastic machine. People are on it the whole time. And as you know, it's better to do it to yourself than someone else do it, right? So that is doing very well. We are also pretty good in category B, which is new product to current channels and customers. It's a very effective, productive way of introduce and expand. And then the challenge we have was in the last category, C, where we make those investments as we move ahead. And when we looked upon it, it's like in the two first categories, most of our growth came there, right? And it's type of logical when you think about it, because disruptive technology, as I said earlier, is more difficult to go on when you need to stay on course to deliver every quarter and every year, right? So you type of wait and you hold off, et cetera. So think about them in those three categories. We call them three, four, and five internally, but just to simplify them in that way. And so, you know, you would like to get, for me, you need to first class where you cannibalize yourself. That's a must. You do it the whole time. The very effective way is the second class, right, where you are able to utilize your connections with a channel or customer and introduce new product. We put a lot of focus actually now on that category to see how can we boost that even more, right? So Ashish Kampur, that is our new CTO, is driving that with additional emphasis into all businesses.
Okay, last question. Dave Begleiter.
Thank you. Dave Begleiter, Deutsche Bank. Nick, one more time on Raws. What are your Brent and WTI forecasts for 2015? And what is your earnings sensitivity to a $10 change in oil prices in 2015?
The 15 to 25 cents earnings per share impact from raw materials is built around an assumption of oil prices being between $60 and $70 a barrel. And then the second part, sensitivity, a $10 move in oil prices, I'm doing the math as I think here, probably two cents. About 2 cents, David.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks for coming. It was a great day. I appreciate your attention very much. And if you have follow-ups, please let us know. Thanks.
Thank you.